passion, the discipline, the focus, the hard work. You get rid of your ego as a bodybuilder, you will be successful.
Straight out the lab. On today's episode, I speak with a legend. Beyond his incredible career as a bodybuilder, he is also a pioneer in the sports nutrition world, as well as the guy who created the term shredded glutes. This episode is personal for me, as my career was slingshotted forward by our relationship, and some of my business endeavors were molded from his shared experiences. We take a trip down memory lane of our years spent together, and he shares some invaluable advice that should not be missed. Here's a podcast with the legendary Rich Gaspari. Rich Gaspari, welcome to Straight Out the Lair, my friend.
Glad to be here.
It's an honor to have you. Obviously, we have so much history, got so much to talk about. And thank you very much for flying in just for this podcast. I just want to give you a flowers for doing that. Thank you, my friend.
I didn't want to miss it for the world. I'm really proud of you. You know, being the guy who brought you here to the U.S., well, being sponsored,
yeah,
is your first was your first brand that sponsored you. So
I know. And again,
I'm very, like I said, seeing how you went from being the athlete to the entrepreneur is something that I'm really proud of. You and other athletes that work for me that have been able to do that, it's just an amazing thing.
Listen, thank you so much. I know this podcast will go in many different directions, but I do want to start off this podcast because you've got some exciting things that are going on right now that I want to talk about, and then we can go into whatever, again, the podcast takes us. But what is going on right now in the world of Rich Gaspari that you've told me a little bit, but I said, stop. Yeah. We're going to talk about it on the podcast.
We have a documentary coming out about me, and the documentary is my history. I'm a guy who never gives up. It's about moving forward, even when you have setbacks. And that's what the documentary is about. I had a guy, basically a film artist, that Frank Zerillo is his name. He decided he wanted to follow me around for the last 3 years. And he followed me around in the gym, at the shows, and got to know who I really am. Took a lot of my old stuff and went through the history of what I'm about. And this whole thing came about, and now Generation Iron is going to be putting it out the week of the Olympia.
Oh, fantastic.
So it's going to be, it's basically my story. I'm a guy that's had setbacks, but always moved forward. And people in life, to be successful is never giving up. And I always tell people that. So many people say they're, you know, they're shit out of luck, they have bad luck, and there's no such thing as bad luck. It's just always, you know, if you have something that sets you back, you just keep going forward and fix the situation.
So dare I say it, you truly are showing like the vulnerable side of everything and talking about how you've become the legend that you are, and show your business growths and your trials and tribulations.
From the business growths to the setbacks to the to bringing it back and continuing doing, like you said, I have so many chapters in my life that I'm about. And there's a lot of things that I've done wrong, but always learn from my mistakes to keep moving forward. And I believe in life, as long as you never give up, you are successful in what you can do in life.
And there's some other business endeavors that you're getting involved with as well?
I'm getting involved in other businesses that still include my name. Right now I have a brand called Gaspari Ageless. It's an anti-aging brand. We have products. As I've gotten older, which I hate to admit, I reach 60 now, which is, it's hard to believe that I'm 60, but I had to come up with a brand that I started seeing, like, I'm having all these aches and pains, issues, like men have issues with their prostate, their heart health, mental fog, so I want something to make have more clarity. So I came up with those products that we're selling online, and they're doing well. I don't know if I had a setback over a year and a half ago. A lot of bodybuilders were dying. We saw about Sean Roden at 47 dying. And I've always been healthy and training and eating right, but I didn't go for the full physical with a cardiologist because they said, I really want to check my heart. And I went through all these gamuts of tests to do, and one of them is called I tell people to get this test done. It's called a C-score because I had a stress test and a EKG and all these tests, and it didn't determine I had any issues. But then when I did this, C-score is basically calcium that goes into your arteries. And mine was so high that they told me I had to go right into the hospital. And And what they do today is, I didn't have any open heart surgery or anything, but they now go through your wrist and they basically go in and they look at your heart and you're wide awake while they're doing this. So while they're going into my heart, they saw one of my arteries was 70% blocked, which then they said to me, we're going to put a stent. Stent's a little tube that goes in and opens up the artery. But the one they call the Widowmaker, which I was saying, what about the Widowmaker? And that's the one of the main arteries to your heart. But what was really fascinating is that my body in the 20 years formed a bypass. It's called a God's bypass, where even though that artery is getting blocked, my body formed other arteries to feed the heart. So because of that, I didn't die. I'm here.
Thank God.
Still here. And they left that alone because they said the other arteries are feeding the heart. And what taught me a lot about staying healthy, eating healthy. I was like, you try to stay. I love training and I love trying to be a bodybuilder. But you have to come to the conclusion that you want to, as you age, you have to learn to stay healthy in how you eat, how you train. And that's what I did. And I'm fine now. I say to anybody that's past 50 is to go to a cardiologist, go to a urologist to check your prostate. My dad died of prostate cancer, so I constantly check that. Check your colon. Those are three. If you check those three, heart, colon, prostate, those are all preventative measures to prevent yourself from dying. Mm-hmm. That's something that I'm really into, wanting to stay on this earth as long as I can.
You talk about the Widowmaker. I think everybody's heard of that. That is something that just hits you and you're done. It's just taken off this earth with a blink of an eye. And some people have healthy walking around unaware of this.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is the arteries found another alternative to getting that blood around?
Exactly. While it was being blocked, slowly other arteries were forming to feed the heart, which is very rare.
Yeah.
But the cardiologist said it's very rare, but he says you're one of those few people that had that.
Uh-huh.
So I guess God or someone up there wanted to keep me alive and made those bypasses.
Isn't that the story of you, though, Rich? Never giving up. Even your fucking arteries are not giving up. Like,
they're not giving
we
up.
We got to keep this guy alive. And again, I think this is, first of all, it's an incredible story. And that's something I didn't even know until after the fact, and you kept that quiet. Obviously, it happened so fast that within that day of you hearing this news, I mean, you probably were, holy fucking scared shitless, thinking what the hell going to be happening.
I'm a guy who was like, about being healthy, eating right, and staying lean. And when I got the test done and the doctor's telling me, like, listen, you can die, it just really just set me back. And then it got me depressed a little bit. And then I thought about it. I said, okay, this is a good sign that I went to the hospital. I went to do all these tests. A lot of people don't. We lost Mr. Olympia, Sean Roden. Maybe he could have prevented that. I think a lot of issues with your heart can be prevented if you go see a cardiologist. And like I said, after 50, especially us guys, listen, I'm not going to sit there and not admit that I've taken steroids. I've taken steroids as a pro bodybuilder. And part of those reasons when I asked the doctor, is it because of the steroids? He said, absolutely no. He goes, when he asked me about my family, I had a lot of uncles that died in their early 60s, late 50s. So it is genetic, but because I asked, can it be steroids? And he said, it can be, maybe it can accelerate the process, but you can't just blame it on steroids. That's the reason why I had these issues with my heart.
So what was the first thing that, obviously you said you went through some sort of depression at the stage, but coming through that, what were the new bucket list things that you had in your mind that you wanted to attack?
It's living life to the fullest and being grateful. A lot of people are out there, they just wake up and they're miserable just when they wake up in the morning for no reason.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you're alive, and I think about, I had setbacks in my life, but I'm still alive, I'm still healthy, I have healthy kids, still doing well financially. So for me, I'm grateful for what I have. Do I want to do more? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I always tell myself in the morning, I have this kind of thing where I meditate. I don't know if you meditate, but it's something that I started doing. When I started doing 3, it's really hard because what you got to do is just block out everything in your mind. Just have your mind open and just focus on your breathing. Huh. So I started doing 3 minutes, then 5 minutes, then 10 minutes. So every morning I go into this meditation and I believe it really helps. Really? Like I said, I get up, I say to God, I'm grateful for what I have, but I want more. And I do that. I do my meditation, which basically clears my mind of everything. Mm-hmm. And that's how I start my day. I get up super early in the gym. I get up 5:30, go to the gym early. Part of it was because of COVID when all the gyms closed down. And this gym went through the COVID time as well. I was trying to find a gym to train in, and actually a friend had his gym, and he goes, listen, this is ridiculous. It's like you would get arrested going to the gym and training.
Especially where you from.
Yeah, New Jersey is terrible. So he's, yeah. You have to come to the gym at 4:30 in the morning while it's still dark. You got to park your car in the back. You got to sneak in. So I'm training in the gym in the dark.
Yeah.
I'm training in there. And I'm thinking to myself, this is fucking ridiculous. I have to train in the dark. You know, like... to be able to get my workout.
You and I have trained in some weird places, but that's for later in the podcast.
Yeah. But still, it was something for me. It's like training is, I love training.
Yeah.
And when I became a bodybuilder, there's some pro bodybuilders that I heard actually one of them was like Flex Wheeler. He's like, he had the greatest genetics, but he didn't like training.
He didn't. He's been a fellow guest of the show. He spoke about it very openly.
And he goes, I don't like training. See, I'm a guy who loves to train.
Yeah, you do.
And that's the thing that's different than him and I. And it's still able to make myself to become one of the best bodybuilders of my era, mm-hmm. because I loved to be a bodybuilder at that time. That was one of the best times that I feel in my life that I was able to, just like with you, it's just you're doing your thing where, mm-hmm. you know, you get up, you're training, you're traveling, you're seeing people all over the world. It was just a great experience.
And let's talk about that, because you truly have grown up through bodybuilding. You started at a very young age.
Yeah.
I remember that there's photos that you showed me. I think you were like 14 or 15. In fact, I think we might have one of the photos up in for Tyus to throw up. But this is you at 15, I think.
15,
is it 40? So what age did you start training?
I started training when I was 13 years old. And the way I got into training is that I had a friend that I used to play, and he was like 11 years old, and I went into his basement, and when I went to his basement, his father had a collection of old Muscle Builder magazines. So I saw all these magazines, stacks of magazines. I started looking at them, and I'm looking at all these bodybuilders, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Lou Ferrigno, Robbie Robinson, and all these bodybuilders, and I was looking at these guys, and holy crap, look at these guys. These are like superheroes to me.
This is you, we are 15 years old, Rich.
Yeah, that's me, 15. And when I saw that, I said, I want to be able to go to the gym, and I wanted to take these magazines home, but this kid was like, my dad will kill me. Can't touch the magazines. So I had to buy them myself and start reading the old magazines to learn, like, how do you build your body like that? And I was one of those kids. My dad was an immigrant from Italy, and he really never taught me any sports. So I was not like the most coordinated kid when I was like, but you want to teach your kids sports very early, 7, 8, 9, 10. Never learned any sports. My dad was a mason, bricklayer, always working, coming home late, and never really taught me anything like how to throw a ball or how to play football, how to play basketball. So I wasn't one of those kids that were like there playing, you know, sports. So when I saw this bodybuilding, I saw it was a more of an individual thing that I'm not going to be judged by people on how I train, but it's just something that stuck. I started training at 13, and it just kept training and training.
And what age did you do your first show?
I started competing. That picture there is when I did my first show. I was 15 years old. I went into my first show. I came in last place, but I still went into the show because all these kids that were like 19 were winning. But I said, I'm going to come back and I'm going to win that show. So I came back the year later at 16. Yeah. I got fifth place. I came back 17, got third place. Came back 18, won the show, won that same show. But it was funny because I was 18. I won that show. And then there was a teenager I beat who was a heavyweight. Now, I beat that guy in the teenage show, but then he went into the men's show, and he won the men's show, but I didn't go into the men's show. So I beat that guy. I would have won also the men's division, but I didn't, because I said, I'm a teenager. I'm just going to go in the teenage show.
Was it an end goal for you, or was bodybuilding like your sport at that point in time, and everything that you were doing was aiming to become, or was that something you were doing aside everything else?
I wasn't really, when I went full bore into bodybuilding, I was a kid that, you know, didn't play any sports. I started getting bigger. So then in school, high school, they were trying to get me to play football. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I wasn't interested in playing football. I didn't care about playing football. Yeah. I remember there was a gym there and it had this universal stack. and these kids were trying to rep out one rep on the whole stack. Mm-hmm. I went in there one day to see, look, all these kids. I went in there, I put it all the way to the last stack, and I go, boom, 10 times. And these kids were, like, trying to do it once. I was like, there you go, coach. And I walked out of the thing.
Bye.
And it's funny because I had a high school reunion. I remember they're saying, oh, you're wasting your time as a bodybuilder. And when I got all my accolades and became Mr. Universe and competing in the Olympia, the coach was like, damn, you really believed in what you were doing, and you made it.
Yeah. So, and then at what age do you think you knew you had the genetics to go on and do well in pro bodybuilding?
Winning a teenage showing and showing that I could have won a men's show, I said, I must have pretty decent genetics. And I, following year, I went into a men's show, which I then won Jersey Cup. And then I was like, you know what? I'm winning the shows in Jersey. But then I was told, like, listen, you're a big fish in a little pond. You're never going to do anything. You're never going to be great. You always have these people, these naysayers telling you're never going to do anything because what you're doing is you're just a nobody. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to end up like, I want to move to, where do I have to go to be the best bodybuilder? And back then it was like going to California. So I had an opportunity. I won the junior nationals when I was 20 years old. Then I went into the nationals. And when I went into the nationals, I came in fifth place. And then I met you met the same guy, Ed Connors. Mm-hmm. So Ed Connors saw me. I went into the heavyweight class. I came in fifth place in the heavyweights. And back then I went against the really great guys. Oh. It was Matt Mendenhall, Rory Littemeyer, Mike Christian. There was like four or five guys. They ended up getting fifth place, this unknown
incredible
heavyweight.
Incredible bodybuilders
too. Yeah, and they were incredible all like, they all yeah. became great legends. Yeah. So he's, Ed Connors says, listen, you're too short and not big enough to go in the heavyweights. Why don't you go in the light heavyweights? I think you have a better shot winning the nationals. I also have a job to offer you at a Gold's Gym that I'm opening up in the Valley. In the San Fernando Valley, I started working. It was in Canoga Park. Actually, no, Tarzana. So I took the job. I was like going to college, and I was a pre-med student at Rutgers University. And I got 2 years into college, and this opportunity came up to move to California. Now, of course, my parents want me to stay in college. And I'm like, I go to my dad, and say, listen, I want to move to California and be a bodybuilder. He goes, are you crazy? What do you mean you're going to go to California and be a bodybuilder? But I was like, this is what I want to do. And if I don't go, if I don't make it in 1 year, I'll give it up, go back to school. But if I make it, I'm going to pursue it as a pro bodybuilder. I quit college and I moved to California to be a bodybuilder.
You were never going back anyway, Rich. No. Yeah, I know that story.
And it just ended up where I was this really cocky kid, Flex. I was lifting heavy weights. I went right into Gold's Gym Venice, challenged guys in there like the Barbarians. Anybody in there, I saw Tom Platz training. I read everything about Tom Platz and was like, whatever he's doing, I can do. Mm-hmm. If he can do those reps, I can do it on legs too. So I went there and just, I was just this kid with this big attitude that I was going to be the best. And I'm now in the big pond. I got to make it in this big pond. It was kind of cool. Like I started training in the Valley and there was an upcoming bodybuilder who just came third in the Olympia, Lee Haney. So Lee Haney watched me train. He was seeing me train. He goes, kid, he goes, man, you train like you an animal. You got spit coming out of your mouth. He goes, I'd like to have you train with me for the Mr. Olympia. I was like, damn, yeah, I'd love to train with you. And that was one of the greatest experiences. Lee honed me into like really train to be a bodybuilder. Because back then I was more like this guy lifting as heavy as I can. But Lee really taught me how to train to proper form, not only proper form, but trying to train my body to be aesthetic. My legs were too big, and he said, you gotta stop training your legs, you gotta train your shoulders, you gotta train your back. And I pushed him on legs, because he wanted bigger legs, bigger calves. He pushed me on my back, my shoulders, to get myself more symmetrical. That year, like I told my parents, I said, I'm gonna win. I was, back then, I don't know if you remember, you have to win the nationals and then go into the world championships. That year, I went into the nationals, won that show, and people don't know this, I got straight seconds. I won that show with straight seconds. I didn't win the show. I won it on points.
Wow.
All the other guys, there was ones, threes, but because I got straight seconds, wow. I won the class, the light heavyweight class. Mike Christian won the overall.
Okay.
Went to the Mr. Universe. there was a guy named, I don't know if you remember back in the day, Gromless.
Okay.
This German guy, really big guy. He was favored to win the world championships.
Yeah.
I ended up beating him. I improved. I gained another like 6-7 pounds because I filled out a little bit. And I won that show. And I came back and my parents were there. And here's something about thinking about being positive. I told my parents, I said, listen, you're going to come to that show. I'm going to win the Nationals. That's in New Orleans. Get your tickets to New Orleans. And get your tickets to Vegas because I'm going to win that show too.
Wow.
And they got tickets to both of those shows. And I ended up winning the Orleans and then went straight to Vegas and won that show. But I was so positive that I was going to win and telling them to pre-buy the tickets because I'll be in Vegas. And it happened. And I always believe about this positive affirmation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You really believe in something and you feel it and you live it, you will. Then it'll become reality.
Absolutely. Yeah, I truly have that same mindset too, and I have had that mindset. If you don't believe, you won't achieve. Believe exactly. To achieve is the saying is.
Exactly.
And obviously, you and I, years later, connecting, which I know we'll get into, but that's one of the things that you've installed in me at a very young age, was that same mentality of believing that you can do it way before you even achieve it. So going back, obviously you won the universe. I know we got images of that. And then you went on to win the world championships that year, right? To win your pro card at 23 years old, right? Oh, no, sorry, no, no. 21 years
I
old.
I just turned 21, yeah. But yeah, I just turned 21 years old, yeah. Winning the world championships. That was actually, it was 2 weeks after the Nationals.
Wow.
Was that show.
Yeah.
So that time, I over-dieted because it was a light heavyweight class. And I should have been 198, as that's the class. I ended up being like 186 when I won the Nationals.
Now that's not it, Tyus. There's a photo of Rich Gaspari. I think it's a few ones. They're labeled in there, mate, underneath the WhatsApp. But a couple of images that we've sent over to you. There's one with you and Joe Weider. I think you're on stage at the World Championships winning, you said, a 21. Now, were you training with Lee Haney at that time?
Yes.
That's the era.
That whole time I was training with Lee Haney. I was living in the Valley. He was seeing Joe Weider. I never got to meet Joe Weider.
Yeah.
For me, it was like, I wanted to be able to meet Joe Weider. Joe Weider, when you made it in bodybuilding when Joe Weider paid attention to you.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously then, years later, I had the same attention from Joe myself. But I want to go back. Let's revisit the era of you and Lee training together. 20 years old at that point in time.
20, yeah.
Turning 21. Training with Lee Haney, which is known as one of the greatest of all time, you and him truly worked together to not only learn from one another, because obviously Lee took you under his wing, but yet your strengths were not his. And it seemed like you guys balanced yourself out. And obviously years later, you became rivals. A year later, yes. A year later. That to me is absolutely mind-blowing. 20 years old, you win. You win the highest accolades you can in bodybuilding, which obviously at the time was the Mr. Universe.
Yeah.
You win the world championships, which a lot of pros now don't do the world championships. No. They just turn pro in their respective countries. But the world championships, even when I was a junior, Dennis Wolf turned pro at the world championships. I feel he was the last big name that I can remember turning pro at the IFBB world championships. But you turning pro, going back then to California to then put your hat back on to train for your first pro show with Lee. And then a year later, third in the Olympia. And then you and Lee then had this
battle.
Incredible battle for a number of years.
And 3 years, 3 seconds in a row. And I always respected Lee genetically. He's a freak. The small waist, the wide back. I look at pictures today, I'm like, I was so confident that I could beat him, and I'm saying, you know what? Maybe I couldn't beat him. He was so superior, and it was the era. He's the 8-time Mr. Olympia. It's the era of Lee Haney.
It was.
It just, if I came in another time, maybe the Samir time, I could have been a Mr. Olympia, I think to myself.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't that. And I always say coming in second was probably one of the best things because it pushed me in life that you need to just keep, like I said, moving forward and pushing yourself to be even better. And I believe being the bodybuilder, I was told that I didn't have the greatest genetics. I put everything together. When I went into the show, it wasn't just about coming in show with symmetry. It was coming in with show being striated, coming with show having the best tan, coming in the show having the best posing routine, even to my hair. Like, I wanted to do every single thing. Everything put together made me that great bodybuilder. Where a lot of bodybuilders, They have great genetics, but they don't study nutrition. I study nutrition, like how to eat properly. I was gluten-free back in the day when people didn't even know about gluten. I was doing that where I could see that when I cut out gluten, that my body got harder. And I did a lot of things just by studying. Because I was a pre-med student, so yeah. I wasn't a dumb bodybuilder. I was studying. If I'm going to be the best in bodybuilding, I need to study bodybuilding and be the best in bodybuilding.
Yeah, I want to make this known, too, because there was not many bodybuilding nutritional books out there. No. There was a couple flying around, but these things I learned when we were on the road together, that you truly created your own diet. There was not somebody that said, hey, you need to follow this plan. You truly made your own. You were eating pasta. You were also weighing things out way before anybody else around you was telling you that they were weighing things out. Because again, you and I, we've got into so many different deep conversations over time. But when you sat me down and you were saying like, yeah, I was the first guy to do this and nobody was doing this. And just tell us about where did that mindset come from that you started weighing everything out and you never had a cheat day or anything like that back then?
No, I was so strict on, first of all, eating for me wasn't a pleasure. Eating was a means to getting my body to look a certain way. Listen, I'm Italian. I loved eating pasta and my lasagna. But when I got into bodybuilding, I knew that eating was a means for me to get to the physique that I wanted to obtain. I believe 75% of successful bodybuilding is nutrition and diet. And when I got into bodybuilding, it was primitive in the diets. Most bodybuilders, what they did is they just ate low carbs. They went on a diet, didn't have any carbs. And I tried to follow that diet and it just made me shrink. I lost muscle. And then I started reading about carbohydrates and complex carbohydrates and the glycemic index. And I really started studying it because I'm like, you know what? I'm going to be a bodybuilder. I have to know this sport scientifically, not just sit there and listen to how people were doing stuff. So I went in and started reading books about what type of carbohydrates are good. I don't know if you remember, it's like Mike Menzer would talk about a calorie is a calorie. And that's not true. You can't sit there and eat white sugar the way you can eat a sweet potato or brown rice. So I looked at things like the glycemic index. I looked at things like gluten. I went gluten-free. Because I studied things about how gluten can make you hold water. So what I did is I started just keeping a log. And it's funny, I read Dorian Yates that he goes, I read about Rich Gaspari. And the reason I kept a log is because Rich Gaspari kept a log. He became a great Mr. Olympia. But I wrote everything down, calories, protein, carbs, fats, put down my diet, how I felt, how I performed in the gym, if I was stronger or weaker. And by doing that, I was able to make adjustments in my diet. And as I was able to come in a condition that no other bodybuilder ever obtained. When I came in, I won what's called the pro, actually went into the Night of the Champions competing against Albert Beckles. And when I went into that show, I went from, I told you I was 188, 189. When I competed in the Night of the Champions, which was, I won in say October, the Night of the Champions was in May. That period I went from 189 215 pounds.
Holy crap.
But I was bigger, harder, and it wasn't some miracle. It wasn't drugs. What it was is I was trying to make this body weight like you, and you had to make that body weight. But then when you can really eat more, my body just sucked it up. And through that whole time, I was gaining 5 pounds, 8 pounds, 10 pounds. And I wasn't getting like fatter. I was just getting bigger and harder. So I went into that first pro show, which was a big deal back then. Going into the Night of the Champions was the show that if you won that show, you would become a top Olympian. So I went into that show, and the guy was in there was Albert Beckles. He was a veteran in the sport, freaky bodybuilder. It was funny because I was the youngest. He was the oldest. He was back then, I think about it, he was like in his 50s. But he was...
It's like Benjamin Button.
Yeah, that's him. But he was amazing. But when I went into that show, and first of all, I'm from New Jersey. It was a New York crowd. So the whole crowd was just nuts when I went on stage.
I bet.
And when he won, just everybody was booing.
Shut up. No way.
But it was great because he was great.
Yeah.
I just changed so much. And you remember Wayne DeMille, he goes, you just shocked the bodybuilding world. He's like, where did you come from? No one thought of you being anything when you won the Mr. Universe. But now you're like this pro bodybuilder going from this 188 to 215 pounds. I became a competitor and I became a contender to the Mr. Olympia from that point. And it's funny because in the Olympia was then in September, October in Belgium. And Lee, I was at Lee's first Mr. Olympia, the one in 1984 that Sergio Livi was in, where he held up
Sergio Jr.
Saying, here's the new myth. And like I told you, Joe Lee Haney was a mentor to me. He's taught me a lot. But you know what? I still wanted to beat him. No matter what, I wanted to beat him. And I went into that first Mr. Olympia wanting to win. I proved myself. I beat a lot of guys in that Night of the Champions. I beat guys like Bob Birdsong, Tony Pearson. These are all guys I read about in the magazines. Mm-hmm. Mike Christian, who beat me in the Mr. Universe and also beat me in the Nationals, I beat him. Mm-hmm. So it was gratifying to know that I was able to beat a guy who beat me mm-hmm. and then come back and beat all these pros that I read about in the magazines. Tom Platz, like I said, Tony Pearson, all these guys competed in the show mm-hmm. and won that show. So going into that Mr. Olympia, and then, I don't know, it was like back in, it was September, October from May, coming in third place in the first Mr. Olympia to enter at a young age of 22 years old.
How much of a whirlwind was this for you just to go from, again, the Universe, training with, to move to California, train with Lee Haney, see Lee Haney win his first Olympia. You now have had this incredible rookie debut in your hometown, same area. Now be a name, a face at 22 years old. Like, that's a lot of fame for somebody that young. I know you said you were a little bit cocky. You did tell me that when you were like at 22.
I was very cocky. Okay. You know, I have to admit.
Was it like Conor McGregor cocky that you knew what, you know, you knew what you were going to be?
I knew that I was the best, and I had so many people that told me I wasn't going to be the best. Mm. I remember writers that would say I would never make it. I said, what did you say about what I was not going to do? Please, writers.
Is that Conor McGregor?
That's how I was. I had this attitude, but I had a lot of confidence. And can you imagine at 22 traveling? I just started traveling the world and having me booked in Australia, New Zealand, UK, Germany. This guy that like lived in this little town in Jersey started traveling the world. It was just an amazing experience.
Let's talk about the traveling, because obviously social media didn't exist, right? Shocking, right?
Yeah.
So you truly were only known through the magazines and whispers.
Yeah.
It was the myth, right? So there was like this guy, Rich Gaspari. And for you then to just jump on a plane and go to these other different countries, I remember you telling me stories about how well you were received over there. And take us back to that time where you get off the plane, you're going to one of these seminars that has been sold out and booked. It was true. You were true, like a pop star in a sense, right? Yeah.
It was so different. The time when I was bodybuilding as a pro, we would travel, like you said, doing seminars every day in different gyms and getting paid really well. Like you'd be out there. I made my money doing the seminar, selling pictures, selling shirts, and selling all these items and making like a lot of money. I'd stay.
Even for this time?
Yes, even for this time. I made hundreds of thousands of dollars for a time in the 80s, which probably would be considered millions today with inflation and all that. But what you said is true. Is like we would go gym to gym to gym. And on weekends, which is really interesting, they'd have us pose at nightclubs. So we'd go to a nightclub like in Paris or whatever, and we'd go on this stage. It was really cool. Like, and you go up there and, okay, now we have the world champion, Rich Gaspari. And I'd be there with a couple other bodybuilders and pose at this nightclub, which was really, I thought was weird, but they paid me like thousands of dollars to do it. So I'm like, okay, I'll pose in a nightclub at nighttime. And that's what I did. And it's, I was living the dream.
Yeah.
Can you imagine you're sitting there and I'm eating, sleeping, bodybuilding, traveling, talking about how to train and how to eat and going to nightclubs and posing on stage. That was my life for 15 years of my life.
And I know that you obviously, you wined and dined, picked up and chauffeured around and taken to various different places, but you've got to see the world as a bodybuilder. How hard was it to be so young, try to become the best bodybuilder? Of course, you're not privy of what everybody else is going on. You only know what Rich Gaspari is doing. Because again, you could see now, I could check out the competitor if I was, oh man, maybe I should stay home and be consistent. But no, you were on the road becoming the brand, the business guy. You were truly getting in front of your audience, making lifetime connections that now have transitioned into the other supplement stuff and many other things. But back then, at the very young age, came with distractions. Good-looking guy, you were a ladies guy, traveling around all these exotic countries, posing in nightclubs in your in your skimpies.
Yeah.
I'm sure that became, what's at times, were a distraction.
You said one thing about traveling the world. It was funny. Even though I traveled the world, I didn't sit there and sightsee. The things I saw was my hotel room, the gym, and would drive. Say I was in Paris, I saw, there's the Eiffel Tower. Okay, where's the gym? You just drive by it. Or I was in Sydney, Australia. Oh, there's the Opera Center.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Where's the gym? Yeah. We go to the gym.
I'll attest to this because when we were on the road together, you've been, yeah, I've been to this country before, but I've never seen this. You've told me all these things. Yeah.
When I was with you, I said, you know, because you started traveling with me and I said, let's see things.
Yeah.
Let's see, sightsee. But you were right. One of the things that you said about, I was a rock star. When you're a bodybuilder and, you know, women were throwing themselves, you're a 22-year-old kid. And listen, I was a good kid. But then it becomes really hard when just the distractions of women throwing themselves at you and being so young and being told how great you are, how good looking you are. It was a distraction. And to me, to this day, of like, it's not stuff I'm proud of that I did, but it was part of just me growing up.
Yeah, I think for anybody who's come from a small town,
yeah,
obviously, you and I both can relate, and then you get this kind of notoriety, because I can tell you this, and I know we relate, and we're going to go into some funny stories later, but a lot of these chicks that I had on the posters and the walls now were reincarnated into another figure, but still, they were the FHM models, the Maxa models, and when you work in places like Australia, these are the girls that you have in the booth.
Yeah.
And when you've got like a 30-foot banner hanging above your head, and then all of a sudden you become an interest, right?
Yeah.
The accent sounds cooler and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I know you've got some stories that, of you traveling around the world, but you had at one point in time, you had a few girlfriends in different countries, right?
I would have girlfriends in Europe, girlfriends in South America, girlfriends in the U.S. But that's, like I said, I'm not totally proud of that lifestyle. Yeah. But like I said, you became like a rock star at that time, at that young age. At least I was able to get rid of that to today, where I see how what I was doing as a kid. But I was a kid.
Yeah, but you were still, from, again, the stories you've told me, you were being the age that you were, and then you were still so committed to your craft. You didn't miss a beat, your training.
I didn't go out to, say, I had girlfriends, but I didn't go out and drink. I didn't go to nightclubs. I didn't even know what it was to really drink or to do any type of drug. I never did anything when I was competing. I was so focused on competing. And it's funny because, you know, when I lived in California in the 80s, Coke was really big, cocaine is. And there was bodybuilders using cocaine to get ripped. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? You're doing cocaine? Oh, yeah, this is a great drug to use to get ripped up. I'm like, I'm not using no cocaine to get ripped up. But they were using, you know, they were using drugs. And I'm like, I'm not using drugs. Yeah. I never used those type of drugs to be able to train. I remember it came into like the 90s. One of them was like Nubane.
Yeah.
That was a synthetic morphine. And they're like, yeah, this drug you can take, and when you take it, you'll be able to train harder because you won't feel pain. I said, I love pain.
You fucking love it.
I love the pain.
The fuck you want to block that shit out?
I don't want to block the pain.
Yeah.
But and then what happened? You saw all these bodybuilders, they got addicted to Nubane.
They were taking it on fucking arm day.
They were taking it on, it was crazy.
Yeah.
So I never got into any type of drugs that altered my mind.
Yeah.
It was all to win and be a bodybuilder.
Yeah, and obviously for that era that you lived through and you managed to dance around a lot of these guys, thank God you didn't succumb to some of these new things that were coming out and aid in your prep. Because, listen, you got in shape and you were known for trademark condition. People were chasing you, and then they started adding all these little drugs into the mix to try and chase you. But you were walking on stage the hardest, driest. Fucking, you brought shredded glutes to become cool.
And I never did you know, when I competed, they thought I did diuretics. They thought I did, you know, any type of thyroid drug. Never did any of those drugs.
Yeah.
In the way I got into that condition.
Did you ever play the game of saying, yeah, I'm doing that shit to throw somebody off? Because you were, again, this was for me when I grew up and through the bodybuilding. you were the guy that everybody talked about being, again, the condition of Rich Gaspari. Everybody would say conditioning, and everybody would say Rich Gaspari. Shredded, back to front, stupid fucking glutes, and that obviously became a trademark for me years later, yeah. Which linked us together. But was there any time that obviously they were saying this and this? You just said, yeah, throw them off.
I was too honest.
You were too honest.
Yeah, I was saying, like, people go, do you take thyroid?
Yeah.
Or do you take a diuretic? And I'm like, I never took any of that. And I experimented with diuretics, and yeah. I felt they didn't work. They took all the water out of my muscle. I ended up looking flat. I did use them occasionally when I did guest posings to get in shape, because I was always in great shape. Like, off-season, I was in great shape. But I just knew that if I wanted to come into a show, it had to be through my diet. Mm-hmm. I made sure I had plenty of time to diet. I always felt like people that took diuretics and thyroid, they were trying to get shortcuts to get in shape, or they just didn't know how to get in shape.
Well, one of the things that with us traveling around the world, you know, I took so much things from you, training-wise, nutrition-wise. And what blew my mind was that, and I've said this earlier too, you paved the path for so many bodybuilders in terms of what you've done, because you truly created a lot of, in my eyes, you created the glute pose, right? That was your trademark back then.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of anybody else having that trademark shredded glutes. What was your mindset to get your shredded glutes? Where did that come from?
It's funny, but it was by accident.
Huh.
Because I was getting in condition for my show, and we had a posing room. Mm. And through the mirror, the gym owner would say, let me see what you look like. So I'd start going to my poses, and as I was getting ready for the show, actually the night of the champions, he said, holy shit. He goes, lift up your, because I'm in my underwear. Yeah. He says, lift up your underwear. I lift it up, and he goes, your ass is fucking shredded. And I go, really? He's like, yeah, you got to do something about that. You got to pose your glutes somehow. And what's funny is you see the suits that the classic bodybuilders wear. You notice that they don't show glutes. That was the trunks that we wore. So what happened was I was going to buy those shorts, and I'm like, this thing's covering my glutes. So remember CJ, the girl makes trunks. So
she does all my stuff.
She does all your stuff. So yeah. I go, CJ, you got to do me a favor. I go, I want you to cut my trunks to almost be a Brazilian cut. She's, what? I said, I want to show my ass. She said, I want to show your ass? I don't know if you know this. I was the first bodybuilder to cut my trunks the way trunks are today. It was me who did that.
Really? Everyone, thank you for my benefit.
So all the guys, they were wearing the other type of trunks. And I said, you got to cut my trunks. And then I had to use glue to keep them on, because it would went up my butt. So I had to keep my trunks on. But when I went on stage and I turned around and I hit that back shot, of course, Samir was known for his Christmas tree. So I had a Christmas tree, but I said, okay, now nobody has like straighted glutes. So I turned around to the back and I just hit this shot and went, bang. So when I did that, like that, your pose.
It's your pose. I fucking stole it from you.
You stole it from me. So when I did that and they saw my back and then they saw my ass, they're like, what the hell is that? No one ever seen that in the sport. And from that point, they're like, who the hell is this guy? Where did he come? That's where Wayne DeMille goes, where did you come from? You never look like this. And you were actually, what did I say, like 20 pounds bigger and striated. So from that point, I was known for being this the most cut bodybuilder. It was actually something where it was a gift, but it was also a curse, because I had to make sure I came in that condition. So even if I was better conditioned than, say, other guys, it didn't matter. I had to be Rich Gaspari shredded. If I wasn't Rich Gaspari shredded, the judges would actually place me lower.
Yeah, because you're off is somebody's on.
Yes.
And you had to live up to that the brand that you created.
That conditioning.
Some people will say, oh, man, I suffered like hell to get into that conditioning. How hard did you start suffering, and how long out did you to get into the condition you were?
Honestly, and I do this, like, lately I've been helping people, giving them online diets and stuff, and I'm getting a couple guys ready for shows, and I try to get you ready way in advance. I was ready way in advance. I was ready 2 weeks out from the show. If you're ready 2 weeks out from the show, you can actually coast into the show. And that's something I've always done, is make sure my conditioning was to par 2 weeks out. And then as I went into the show, I would start to actually fill out, because I would basically get my glycogen down so that my muscles were deflated.
Yeah.
And then I would slowly start introducing carbs, cut back on the cardio. So by the time I get on stage, I could gain 3 to 5 pounds from the 2 weeks out that I was in. So was I suffering? I was actually doing less cardio, doing less training, and eating more carbs. So when I went into the show, I felt great.
Yeah.
I wasn't sitting there like dying when I went to the Olympia or any of my shows. I was always like where I felt great, where everybody else was like, oh, I'm dying from my diet. I was never like, I wasn't like that.
So you're telling me you never done anything the week of crazy, like some of these guys where they shitlord and stuff like that? You actually was ready 2 weeks out? Didn't
I was ready.
Do a panic diet?
I did, you know what it is? I say slow and steady. Don't make any drastic changes. If you don't make any drastic changes,
yeah,
you'll be in great shape. It's almost like when people see you in the gym, it's, this is the way you got to look. And then they end up going in the show and it's either they're holding water or they're flat because they make these drastic changes and these coaches that make these guys do these drastic sodium loading or all these different things. They could work.
Yeah.
But I just think, I don't believe in any of that. I always believe that if you could come in shape 2 weeks out where you are contest ready and then slowly fill out. That's the problem. You also have to have a good eye that's looking at you.
Yeah. Because
if you don't, you can end up going in reverse. Because if you're ready 2 weeks out, you can shrink down.
Oh, you can feel the pressure of the show coming closer and then you want to push harder.
You push harder. And that's what you have to have someone.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a coach. My day, there was no coaches.
You coach yourself, right?
You coach yourself. Yeah. But I did have the gym owner that knew my body. And he also told me if I look like shit, you know, I told me, like, am I flat?
Yeah.
Am I hard? Like, he knew my conditioning, so he was my eye those last 2 weeks. It's hard to determine. And this is where you do need a coach to help you when you're getting that last 2 weeks. But I was able to have him tell me, like, you're flat or you need more carbs, you're holding water. So that's how I got myself to know by having somebody who was going to tell me the truth.
Mm-hmm. And you said also about your trademark condition. You have to bring that to every show. And what a lot of people don't know, they don't do know, is the Olympia for you was one show, and then you go straight on the road for sometimes
seven shows.
And you would go and do the Grand Prix, sometimes compete in up to 3 times in a weekend.
Sometimes it would be a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So, that's really hard to peak.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Rich, because a lot of these guys mourn about missing their peak. You ought to do it fucking 3 times in 3 one times. Weekend.
How about this? You compete in a show on Friday. Saturday, Saturday morning, you get on a plane going from, like, UK, and then I'm going to Greece. And as we're going there, we're going right to the venue. So we don't have time to go to a hotel. So while we're on the plane, we're going into the bathroom, putting on our posing trunks. Right. So we're getting right to the show and then going right on. And that's where I went in 7 Grand Prix shows.
Yeah.
I won 4 of them. And at that time, I don't know if you know this, before when I came in 30 Olympia, then I came in second, or I'm sorry, 30 Olympia. Then I won the Pro World. I won the LA Grand Prix. I went into 3 other Grand Prix shows. I never lost a show. The only man to beat me was Lee Haney. So at that time, everybody wanted to beat me. You don't understand? I was trying to beat Lee Haney, but every bodybuilder behind me was trying to beat me to get to Lee Haney. So that Grand Prix show was 7 shows. And like you said, it was shows Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. There's no way you can peak on every show. And that's where I lost. My first loss was to Lee Labrada, which was really devastating to me because at that time, not losing a show was like, oh my God, now I lost. What do I do?
Yeah.
But I came second. And it's funny. It was funny because he beat me, but then a week later, I beat him. And then it was like this rivalry between, I had the Lee Haney rivalry.
Then I had the
Lee Labrada rivalry.
On the Grand Prix.
Yeah, the Grand Prix.
So you guys, that is an iconic rivalry that even any bodybuilding historian will know. If you talk about the rivalries, there's the Lee Labrada, Rich Gaspari era.
Yeah.
Where you guys would literally go one for one sometimes. Yeah. And then you would win a few, then Lee would win.
Yes.
That must have been tough for you guys to share planes and share whatever else to know.
When we were competing against each other, yeah, there was very strong rivalry. He's like one of my good friends now to today, and really, he's a great guy. He's a very spiritual guy. Mm-hmm. He's actually a mentor to me because he's the first guy to start a supplement company.
Yeah.
He was like about a year before me, and then when I saw what he did, that's when I started Gaspari, but Yeah, we were fierce competitors. I wanted to beat him. I didn't want him ever to beat me.
Yeah.
And then when he did, I was like, motherfucking beat me. I got to beat him. But he was to this day, he's a great bodybuilder.
Of course.
He's beaten some great bodybuilders, Kevin Lavrone and Flex Wheeler, and he's a great bodybuilder as well. What was he called? Mass with class.
He's a giant killer. He truly is a giant killer as well. His name doesn't come up with the Danny Perillos and the David Henrys and stuff. But
and posing.
Posing. In my eyes, one of the best ever. Yes. And that's probably one of, again, they'll go down in history as one of the best posers. But again, it was his attention to detail in the posing was, again, your posing routines were built around your physique.
Yes.
His posing routine was built around, like, his classic lines and how he flowed with stuff. And yours was like, look at my physique. I'm fucking...
Yeah. I'd go in there.
Boom.
Like,
yeah.
And because he posed so well, it improved my posing because I said, this guy's going to beat me. Because back then, you actually were scored on your posing.
Yes.
So...
I think it should go back to that, too.
It should, because a lot of bodybuilders just lost the art of posing. And you had great posing routines. And today, with this not judging it, I think is wrong, because it just makes bodybuilders lazy. Yeah. That part of bodybuilding... Anyways, I was able to, like, see his routines that people were like, wow. So I said, man, I got to step it up. I got to really do something different. And I came up with really cool routines that, like you said, fit my body. I knew I had to pose to what my body looked like. I couldn't do his kind of poses. It was like this...
dainty.
For me, that's dainty. I'm not doing those kind of poses.
Nothing against you, Ali. Nothing personal. But again, it would make your physique... I think it would not be detrimental, but again, your routines, as I've said already, fit you. Your rugged muscle, your conditioning. You used to hit big shots on big... Again, everybody... done choreographed music routines, and the music styles you picked suited you too. You'd hit big shots on big notes.
Well, when I did a pose, it was almost like I wanted the judges in the audience just to go, wow, wow. And I was able to do that where I would get into a shot and just slowly then, boom, hit the shot. And then go into another shot, boom, hit a shot. And that was like how I wanted to just wow the audience and wow the judges. Mm-hmm. Lee was more of this elegant transition, and it really was beautiful. When I would watch him, I'm like, damn, this guy's a good poser. You know, it's
apples and oranges.
Yeah,
right?
It was
truly
two different type of physiques.
Do you have any stories that you want to tell? Now it's years later. That might be fun
later
to talk about.
We were in the Grand Prix, and that's when we were like rivals back and back. We're in the same hotel room, and then he ran out of Pro-Tan. So his wife comes and knocks on my door and goes, do you have any Pro-Tan? I was like, I don't want to give him my Pro-Tan. I want to make sure he doesn't get a good tan. But I was like, okay, here's my Pro-Tan. He ran out of Pro-Tan, and I gave it to him. And I remember going through the Grand Prix. One of them was in Spain, and we were in where they had the bullfighting. Mm-hmm. And this thing was like 110 degrees in this where we posed. And they actually had a swimming pool. I don't know why there was a swimming pool there, but I remember we went through this whole thing. We're all like just exhausted. It was like 100 degrees in there. And at the end, we saw this swimming pool. And I was looking at it. I was like, shit, I want to go in that pool so bad. So actually, Lee went into the pool. And then we all just jumped in the pool. And there's a really cool shot of me, Barry DeMay, Mike Quinn, Lee Labrada, that we all were in this pool after the show. And it was just like the best feeling, because we were so just friggin' hot, 110 degrees in this room, in this bullfighting ring in Barcelona, Spain.
I should turn that fucking pool brown, Rich.
Yes,
all the
Pro-Tan came off.
What the hell is going on, yeah?
Yeah.
I want to transition into Gaspar Nutrition, and obviously this is where I come in later on in the conversation, but you mentioned Lee, and obviously he started up Labrada Nutrition a little bit before you got into business. Mm-hmm. The stories of Gaspar Nutrition forming came from very humble beginnings. And I remember you telling me a story about how you started in your parents' garage, right?
I started in my parents' garage and basement. And, you know, people think that, you know, because I was this big top bodybuilder, that I went from being this top bodybuilder to being this big supplement company. It wasn't like that. I don't know if a lot of people know that I got injured. What got me out of bodybuilding was I herniated a disc. I ruptured a disc. And it was funny, yesterday we talked about you not doing shrugs, because I was doing shrugs and I ruptured a disc in my neck, and basically my right side, it affected my right side where my right side got atrophied. And while I was in bed, I'm sitting there and saying, what am I going to do now? I was making my living as a bodybuilder and I can't do it anymore. So I was sitting there. I said, I was so scientific in nutrition and supplementation. I said, I want to have my own supplement company. So I know Lee was already doing it, but Lee had a head start. He was one of the endorsers of Metrex. And what I heard the story was that company started growing really fast. So he was like part owner of that company. So what happened was Scott Connolly wanted to buy him out and bought him out for seven figures. And then Lee had this money to start Labrada. And that's what I heard was the story. For me, I had nothing. I started my company with around $60,000 of my money. And
that's a lot of money.
And just to let you know, when I started my company, with bodybuilding, because of the injury, and I wasn't making money, and I had this house, I went into bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy. Yeah. So the only thing I had left was this $60,000. I moved back to my parents' house, and I did this in my early 30s because I was competing in my 20s. I went all the way up to 33 years old competing, and that's when I got the injury. And my parents were like, move back here, get yourself situated. And I did that, and I started Gaspari Nutrition. And it was funny, some of the things I did was like, I had a Porsche, Corvette. I sold my cars. I bought a minivan. And you want to talk about humbling. You go from driving around a sports car and being this big shot in bodybuilding to driving a minivan and going like place to place. Now, being that top bodybuilder, I was going to each gym that I used to train at that was like with open arms, Rich Gaspari coming in. Now I'm there and going there as Rich Gaspari, the business owner, trying to sell my products. And Flex, I had so many doors slammed on me. They're like, oh, we're not interested. That was just really hard, but I had to just keep trying. And then eventually I had 3-4 gyms, 5 gyms, 6 gyms, 10 gyms, 20 gyms. And I just started growing my company, and that's how I started growing it. But a lot of times I had a lot of doors slammed on me telling me they're not interested. They loved me as the bodybuilder, but they weren't interested in me as the entrepreneur. But I was able to just be persistent. One of the things I did is I started judging pro shows. They asked me to judge. And the reason I did it was to network. It wasn't because I wanted to be a pro judge either, although I enjoy judging, and I'll tell the story how I judged you, I judged Hide, and I got a lot of shit because you were my athlete. And even though you deserved to win, but I was judging you, and that's when I quit. Actually, yeah. when you were my athlete, I told you, Manny, I'm quitting judging because I'm not going to sit there. If this guy deserves to win.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the shows, it was one of the competitors, and I actually scored him lower than the other judges.
I know, because I that. Yeah.
Because I wanted to be so like, anyways, I started judging, and one of the guys I met was Eric Hillman, the owner of Europa. I go to him, I said, he was distributing product. I said, I'd love to distribute my product with you. He goes, I've heard of you, it's Rich Gaspari, but no one's heard of your brand. He's in Charlotte, South Carolina. And he goes, no one's heard of your brand, so I don't think I can get any sales. So what I did, Flex, is I called all the stores in Charlotte. Do you have Gaspari Nutrition? Do you have Gaspari Nutrition? So the guys, no, I don't have Gaspari Nutrition. Eventually, I got these guys to start buying Gaspari Nutrition in Charlotte. So I went back to Eric Hillman. I said, can I get my brand with you guys? He said, well, they're starting to get a demand for your brand in Charlotte. He goes, I'll buy the brand. And then he started buying my stuff, and that's how I got him to start buying stuff. But I was always trying to figure a way, like either through the back door or whatever, trying to get those sales and get these people's attention to get sales. So like I said, I call a store. You got Gaspari? I changed my voice.
I was going to say,
hello? Do you have any Gaspari Nutrition? And the guy would be like, no, what's that? He goes, oh, it's this brand. He's this famous bodybuilder. You got to see this brand. You got to try it out. And I go to another one. Hello, this is Rich Gaspari. No, I would be another voice like, this is whoever. And I was able to fake that to
incredible.
Get these guys to start buying the brand. And then for the distributor, Eric Hillman, to start buying the product. Yeah. And that's how I got sales, and then it started growing.
One of the funny stories you told me about starting up Gaspar Nutrition in your mum and dad's basement was they came into the basement one time and it looked like a scene from Breaking Bad, and they thought you were a drug dealer, they told me, right?
So what happened was I was selling creatine.
Yeah.
So at that time, creatine was huge. So I called some manufacturers about getting it made, but the pricing they were giving me is too high, and they didn't have a huge volume. I had about 1,000 bottles. Mm. So it's funny, I ended up buying the creatine in bulk. I bought the bottles, I bought the labels, I bought the tops. And then what happened was like, okay, I got to do 1,000 bottles myself, like try to do this thing in an assembly. I had a scale. Yeah. So there was a big white powder on my table there.
Like Tony Montana.
But what happened was I'm like, how am I going to do this? So you know what I did? I went into the neighborhood and I found these kids, these 14, 15-year-old kids. So I got about 6 kids to come into the basement. I said, I'm going to give you like $50. You're going to do this work. And he goes, what are you going to do? You're going to weigh this powder. You're going to put it in the can. You're going to screw the top. You're going to shrink wrap. So I had this, like this assembly line, like Ford, you know, doing this. So I made all these bottles, like in 2 days. I paid these kids the money. And to this day, it's funny because these kids are now in their mid-30s. And there's some of these guys, one of them a cop. He goes, I was like, I'm a cop today. It was this 15-year-old kid in your basement. This is pile of white powder, like put it in this can.
It's creatine. Don't worry, kids. It's creatine.
It was funny because my dad came down and he's like coming down the basement and he sees his table and this big, what is that there on the table? Yeah. I go, Dad, it's nothing. It's just creatine.
Didn't you tell me a story about your mother crying when she thought it was you were a drug dealer?
She thought I was a drug dealer. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, Mom, I'm not a drug dealer. Don't worry, I'm not a drug dealer. She saw this. I go, I said, see all these cans I showed them and everything. Yeah. I'm going to sell all these and because I'm going to get them cheaper. So I started, like I told you, I had all these gyms and stores. I was able to sell creatine cheaper. I said, you can buy my creatine. I can give it to you like $5 cheaper. And that's how I made a profit on that. I was like doing this with these kids, like this assembly line.
You're a hustler, Rich. That's one thing I will say for sure about you. We've got some incredible stories that some I will share on the podcast, some I won't. But that transitions into our relationship years later. Gaspari, now, oh my gosh, you signed me to 22 years old and Gaspari was really becoming name. We weren't the name that we became when I was part of the brand, but we were on that first kind of skyrocket trajectory. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I can't even remember. Actually, remind me, how did you find out about me? Because I didn't want to ask you yesterday because I wanted a lot of the stuff. Because let's be honest, you and I popped way too many stories yesterday. Yeah, and I kept saying, Rich, don't. But the story of how you and I, or shall I say, you found out about me, where did that come from?
As a brand, I wanted to get the next Rich Gaspari, like this upcoming bodybuilder that I would see would have the potential in being, you know, the next Mr. Olympia. So I was looking about for these bodybuilders, and I think it was Tom Hoops who said, I got this kid, he's in England, he's in UK, and he's coming up, and he just won the UK championship, so he just turned pro. So I'm like, okay, let me see. And I saw pictures of him. He really has great symmetry, great shape. I think this guy can go somewhere. He's really good. I want to get an upcoming guy that can be part of the brand and grow with the brand. So I didn't know at that time that you weren't pro. You were just an amateur, and I end up signing you. And then, was it 2 weeks later?
2 weeks later.
He wins the show, and you turn pro. And I'm like, you weren't pro when
you
I signed
pro?
You?
You weren't pro? Yeah. But he didn't tell me that until months later. Yeah. You were like, wait a minute. Just so you know, I signed you as an amateur. I wasn't going to say anything, but that's the faith I had in you. You're trying to, like, wangle it back. But a lot of we told the world at the time that, yeah, Rich believed in me. And sign me. But again, I think you found out before I turned pro. I think that the true story
is... No, I saw the potential in you. I saw you were going to go somewhere in the sport. You had great symmetry, great back, and you were just coming up.
Yeah.
So for me, I said, this kid's going to go somewhere.
And from my end, I was speaking to a number of different companies. Muscle Tech was one, and at that time, Muscle Tech was
the company.
The brand. It was the brand, and they had absolutely everywhere. You guys go back to me think what year this was, 2002 maybe, or 2002 to 2006. I may have been. Muscle Tech had absolutely
every pro.
They had Jay, they had Dexter, they had Branch, they had Johnny Jackson, they had everybody who was somebody in that top 10, minus one or two.
Yeah.
They were all under the Muscle Tech umbrella. So Muscle Tech came to me and they wanted to sign me, and then Gaspari, he wasn't you and I, he was somebody else, or somebody part of your team that were interested. And I sat back and I was like, I could be one of 10 guys and I'll earn my stripes through time, or I could be one of one and have this incredible apprenticeship and learn from the man himself who has paved the way and gained the knowledge. And I'm so blessed, so lucky that I didn't go for the shiny toy that was being waved in front of me. I went with the long-term, in my eyes at the time, the long-term relationship. And I'm so grateful that even at my young age of 22, I had the maturity to see what was in front of me. And my gosh, what an apprenticeship. I truly believe that the reason why I am the way I am is because, again, you never once pushed me out of a meeting. You encouraged me to come in. So I got to hear firsthand
the business meetings,
the business side of Rich Gaspari, what goes on behind the scenes to get these brands into India, into Germany. There's a lot of things that people don't understand, from import, export, going through the, there's different rules and regulations. There's changes that have to be done to certain products, because I remember one time you tell me, like, vitamin C in one product is way too high for that country.
You have to go lower, yeah.
And I got to hear firsthand on how the business is done behind the scenes, behind the Wizard of Oz curtains. And again, I just want to personally thank you on this podcast for seeing what you've seen in me, but then educating me, not only on the bodybuilding side, but also on the business side. So thank you very much, Rich, because you brought me into every single meeting.
And it was funny. I wanted to really show you, like, that there's life after bodybuilding, because I saw you as this young, upcoming bodybuilder. Then there's a lot of bodybuilders. There's stories. I don't want to mention names, but I've seen bodybuilders that were, like, big, you know, during Arnold's time. And then I go to this gym to go see him, and he's driving this beat up old car, and he's a janitor, you know, and he's still training there, but he didn't make any kind of business out of it. And I said, I never want to be that bodybuilder. I want to be a guy who's going to go beyond bodybuilding. And we talked about this pre-podcast.
Podcast before podcast.
Yeah, and part of what I say to any person that goes into business, or any bodybuilder that's successful, if you take the attributes of being the best bodybuilder in the world, and that's the passion, the discipline, the focus, the hard work, you put those attributes into a business, you get rid of your ego as a bodybuilder, and you take those attributes and you let go of the bodybuilding and you put it into your business, you will be successful. And that's what I wanted to teach you. You're going to have a life after bodybuilding. I saw it in you that you were going to go beyond just being this bodybuilder. You were going to be successful. And it's funny because I remember just you coming in and turning pro, and then all the shows, the setbacks that you went through. I was there with you.
You were.
And all those setbacks that I was there with you. And to me, it was like, I felt when you were competing, like you were my son. And I was like feeling when you were let down, or when you were a show you should have won, you end up not winning. And it was a great experience with you as well. Us traveling the world. Oh. The one thing I wanted to show you is like flex, because I remember a lot of bodybuilders goes, if you work for Rich Gaspari, he's going to make you work. Other brands are just going to take pictures of you and then they'll just leave you and you'll go to the Olympia to work the booth.
Yeah.
But you're not going to work. Rich is going to make you work. So I go to you, I go, Flex, if you work for me, you're going to work. Mm-hmm. We're going to travel together. We're going to go to different countries together. But I'll make sure that you train every day. I make sure you get your 6 meals in. But you're going to learn a lot. And this is why I took you into business meetings, because I wanted to show you that you weren't just handed money. I wanted to teach you, you know what I'm saying? You know,
true.
The whole thing in the Bible is like, you can give a man a fish, but if you teach a man to fish, if you give a man a fish, he can eat for one day. But if you teach a man a fish, he'll eat for a lifetime. And that's something that I wanted to give to you, being this entrepreneur, that I was very fortunate to be successful and seeing then this progression of you getting better and becoming this famous bodybuilder.
and that you did. You gave me the fucking fishing rod, the hook, and the worm. And you said, cast in this direction. But it goes back to what you said, and I want to make sure that these pros know that are listening to this. Everything's at this, you know, well, my career just happened. They don't want to hear about what I done, because you signed me at that transitional period where magazines were still popular,
yeah,
and social media was also in its infancy stage. When I jumped on a plane and we went to Australia, for example, and to get picked up on a wrapped car that had my image on it, and then to get driven to a store and have this massive line and have my image much bigger than yours on the windows. It was very motivating. It was very humbling. Your photo was just as big as mine. Just to make
now
sure
listen,
you know.
You were the star, so it didn't matter.
Well, we were fighting it out at times. And we developed this true family brotherhood, which I still talk about to this day. You won't hear me saying a single bad word about Gaspari, because I never had anything. I never had a bad experience. And if I had some bad experience, you came down on somebody like a ton of bricks. I remember when I was in Sweden 1 year and the whole, we were working, and remember, not the names, but Tony Freeman got popped. And I was working for Gaspari on the booth.
Yes.
And I said, Rich, what should I do? You go, get on a plane and get the hell out of there.
Get out of there, because they were arresting people.
Yeah, for looking at bodybuilders.
By looking at body, this is ridiculous. This shows you like socialism to the highest, where if you look like a bodybuilder, they can take you and test you, even if you had nothing on you. And if you tested positive, they could put you in jail. And you were there, and I'm like, get the fuck out of Sweden.
Yeah. I literally landed. So I was like, no, Rich, don't worry about it, Rich. I'm cool. So I remember going to the expo. And I think this is at the part in the podcast where we start talking stories.
Yeah.
And I was working on the booth, and next thing, something happened, and I got whisked out the back door.
Yeah.
And I remember getting on the phone.
Because they had the police coming.
Yes. There was actually an anti-doping police booth in this expo, which blew my mind. But at the same time, and unfortunately I can say this story, but there was a suicide bomber in another part of the country that detonated a bomb in the middle of a street. Didn't kill anybody, but all them police activity left the expo. And I called you. I said, Rich, what should I do? Should I go back work the booth? And you're like, get the fuck out of there. And I was like, okay. So what I didn't know, that you don't know to this day, is I went back to the expo, worked a little bit, because just like you, I love seeing my fans.
Yes.
And I refused to not go to the expo. I'm very blessed to have that crazy hour, 2 hour line.
Yeah.
And I made it to the expo. I'm going to do 1 day appearance. I think it was like 2 hours. We run the line to nothing because we obviously capped it out. And then they whisked me out the back door straight to the straight to the plane and on my way I was. But we have got my memories of us traveling together. Incredible. We've been to so many different countries over the years that I was sponsored by Gaspari. And I truly attest my fame and my notoriety to being a Gaspari athlete. And I'll tell you why. Social media was in its infancy stage. We would go around the world. We would do tours around the world. And we would spend a week here, 2 weeks there, 4 days there. And we would go, in some cases, 2 appearances a day in different countries. And these fans would come out. Again, I'm in my 20s, very similar story to you, and get this notoriety, this fame. Granted, I wasn't cocky like you, but and I had this incredible fan base that was lining up.
Yeah.
No social media. Now, turnkey, when social media came about, because I had gone to all these store appearances and because I jumped on these little puddle jumpers.
Yeah.
I remember me and Ronnie Coleman doing an appearance together. We went to New Zealand. Shout out to Shano, my little brother over there in New Zealand. We would do a New Zealand tour, and the plane was only big enough for myself and Ronnie because we had the traveling circuses of bags.
Yeah.
I had 4 bags full of merchandise that I was selling.
Yeah.
He had his bags full of merchandise.
Yeah.
So they put us on this prop plane, and we'd done island hopping all over New Zealand. And these guys, you'd land, and the line was down the street, and we couldn't go through people. So then we'd go to the next door appearance, and these people were jumping in their cars, hanging out the windows, taking photos of me and Ronnie. We get to the next appearance, and they would rejoin that line. But again, these people weren't used to seeing pro bodybuilders coming to their little island. And you recognized that putting me on the road was not only going to build your brand, you give me the opportunity to not only grow myself, grow this brand too, but you give me a lot of importance. I felt that brand was mine. And I truly wore it like a badge of honor all around the world. And I, not only on the bodybuilding stage, but I try to become the utmost professional in everything I done, because you and I would share stories and you said, Flex, don't do what I done and be cocky. Make yeah. time, do this, do that. But then I got to see the advice that you would give me would be the exact same thing that you lived next to me.
Yeah.
And we would do these appearances, just say domestically in the US. We would go to one supplement store, which is a bodybuilding store, and we'd have a line down the street. The next day, we'd go to a little mom and pop health store, and it was just me and you standing there.
There's nobody there.
And I thought to myself, man, this is my boss. This is the guy that I'm obviously representing his brand, but obviously he's like a big brother to me too. And you would have hundreds of sales the day before, and we were talking to a consumer that was asking, is there steroids in this? And you would still give him the time, the attention, yeah. no ego to understand what the brand you sold. And I truly respected that, because yes, you're Rich Gaspari, the legend, but yet you were standing in a supplement store where nobody knew me, nobody knew you, and you still cared to put that time and attention into every one of your store appearances. And that is why your brand grew significantly to the point where we were chasing BSN, and that rivalry became incredible. But before we talk about the BSN thing, again, flowers to you about what you've done all around the world. And I got to see my boss, who didn't really have to leave New Jersey. Let's be honest. You could have stayed in New Jersey and cut a check and sent an athlete on the road to do that, but you were with me. Why did you choose to do that?
I just felt that what you just said is, if I was in my ivory tower, a lot of times that you saw, I saw business owners that weren't connecting with the consumer. I wanted to be able to connect with the consumer, and going on the road and listening to people, good or bad, would help me make a better brand. I saw before me, none of these owners would go anywhere. They just stay in their ivory tower. They'd send an athlete out. And I said, you know what? I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to go out there, and I want to hear from the consumer. I want to hear from these people using my product, good or bad, because that would teach me to improve my brand. So going with you and sitting there and someone saying something stupid about it, that's steroids, I was very polite. I say, no, this does this and that, and actually win that person over. Like for me, it was always about winning over a customer. If I could win one customer over, that customer would be a customer for life. And that was my whole philosophy. For me, traveling from place to place was just growing my consumer base. Yeah. I wanted to grow that consumer base. I wanted to be there to know, good or bad, what is the issues with my brand? What do I need to do to improve my brand? Mm-hmm. To me, like we talked about earlier, is the brand was me as a bodybuilder. I was this brand now. I had to make it the best brand in bodybuilding. In the sports nutrition, where I was trying to improve my body. Here's the big difference. When you're a bodybuilder, you have genetic limitations. Why didn't I beat Lee Haney? Because he's had great genetics. I was able to get as high as I could. But then when you are a business person, the sky's the limit. You can achieve anything as a business person. If you can do the hard work, focus, plan, all these things that make you a successful business person. So for me, it was like, you know what? I'm going to do everything possible. I'm going to travel on the road. Listen, I was out there just like you, going place to place. And I said, Flex, I'm going to work hard with you. You're going to go on the road. A lot of bodybuilders, they don't want to work for me because I'm going to work them too hard. But like I said, we're going to have fun doing this. And like you said, I was able to grow the awareness of who you are in New Zealand, Australia, Europe. We went to the FIBO. We've been to like even UK. I remember like all the stores that we had in the, I mean, of course you were famous in the UK, but still those stores with huge banners, bigger than mine, of you in the window.
Yeah, about that. No, but you would also do things on the road where you challenge people. And you would say, if you can outwork me, we would do these training days in different gyms. And, yep. and I look back and I think to myself, wow, we worked so fucking much. We would do so much. We would truly maximize every single day. We'd have no days off.
Yeah.
We would do a store period. Like maybe we'd do a training session in the morning. And then we would go and work, we'd do an appearance, and then we would do maybe a train with.
Yes.
And you would do these train with Rich and you would try
Rich
to.
Rich and Flex.
Yeah, train with Rich and Flex. And these fans that were gym goers that were part of the gym that we were doing this event at would jump in with us and they would try to outwork us. And we'd done it in the UK, we'd done it in Poland, we'd done it all over. And we fucking smoked these guys, these biggest guys. Some of these guys were purple.
And remember that it was like, it was a get to train with Rich and Flex.
Yeah.
And then at the end, we'd kill this guy. And the guy goes, what the hell did I win?
I think I lost.
He's on the floor, all dead. That was the whole thing. And you made a good point, like going back to 12 years ago, 15 years, I was like challenging people at any store. I said, if you can beat me in the gym, I'll give you $10,000 in product.
Yeah.
Remember we went through Canada. And they were trying to find people like ringers to try to beat me. And I'd always figure out, I did like the Muhammad Ali rope-a-dope. I'd let them beat me on certain exercises. And in the end, I'd end up doing like drop sets and supersets. And I had a lot of endurance in the gym. So I end up killing the guy. And I'm like, okay, you're not getting the $10,000 in product.
Yes, because you would give us a massive price. So these guys were truly trying to do it too. But you were always that bodybuilder. And people would laugh and joke and say, Rich, why are you still training so hard? But you just loved it.
I love training. To this day, I love training. Listen, I have a lot of limitations with injuries and stuff. I had that surgery. Over a year ago, I had that surgery on my neck. I had a disc replacement done. Mm-hmm. And still, my right side is, I don't have the strength, but I'm still pushing myself to go to the gym every day to try to train. Because I love doing it. And I have social media, of course, they're like, why are you doing that? You're old. You should be stop training. I'm like, listen, I love training. But you're going to hurt yourself. I said, I've been training now for 40 years. I'm not hurt. That injury I had was from when I competed, but I'm not hurting myself. I didn't hurt my back. It hurt my knees. I don't hurt any myself. So I love doing it.
Yeah, you truly do. We trained yesterday and yes, you're crazy, man. You're still doing some crazy, like again, you're throwing around some stupid way. When we trained together, there's a couple of photos of you and I training on the road. And obviously you knew my limitations. One of my Achilles heel was I always had stomach issues, which obviously ended up retiring me.
Yeah.
And you got to see it firsthand. We'd go to different countries and you were force feeding me. Come on, Flex.
Gotta eat.
You would, I want to point this out too, but when we would train on the road together, you would grow on the road.
You'd get bigger.
You would get bigger. And then you'd be reminding me, it's like, oh my God, I'm hungry. I was like, Rich, we just ate. Come on, we got to go. We got to win the Olympia. And I was like, okay. And then obviously that came into fruition. You mentioned earlier about seeing and living through me vicariously, and then you got to see the heartbreak of the last year of the 202 when it was myself and Kevin English going down to the wire, and obviously everybody backstage thought I was going to win. It never happened, but just like you said earlier, it was probably the best thing.
Second place is the best thing to happen to you, Flex, because you know what, everyone said you deserve to win that show, and you have to be humble and accept that second place. Because next year, you're going to be even better.
Yeah.
And when you win that show, it's going to be so much more gratifying. It's going to be an amazing thing. And I got to tell you, it still is emotional to me because that when you did win the Olympia, and I remember just seeing you win, and it just, like, I started. And you kept, what are you crying for? And then you started, like, getting emotional.
Oh, my God. When I lost, everybody was crying. And when I won, everybody was crying. There was nothing I could have done other than just cry.
Just cry.
I want to say, though, that there was nothing better for me to see the joy that you had backstage.
It was the greatest. It was so great because, like I said, I didn't get to win the Olympia, but you did. And through living through you, it was just an amazing thing to see. It's almost, I feel like you're my little brother, and you won the biggest show in bodybuilding. Something that you were, when you came to US with your first show, the Tampa Pro, to all the shows, I was with you there on those shows, and then finally winning it.
And that's crazy. I just thought about this because my first pro show was Europa.
Yes.
And obviously you had that connection with Eric Hillman. And backstage then coming second, you had the right words to say at the right time for me when I got that 202 placement. And then when the 212 became the show that's remained and stayed, that was £10. So just like you in that the Night of the Champions, I had the ability to eat up into a show, which I couldn't do. I was ready 2 weeks out, just like you, and I would eat in to get into my better and best look. So to win that show, then to walk off, and then there's photos of us backstage and stuff, which I'll get for the podcast. I remember also, funny story, but my trophy went missing backstage, and I was like, somebody's fucking stole my trophy. And after a small 10-minute search of trying to get this trophy and everybody stopping and taking pictures, who had my trophy? Fucking Rich Gaspari walking around taking photos with it with all the press back there. He was like this.
It was my trophy.
Holding his trophy like this. Holding my trophy. Taking it as if it was his own. But I want to transition back to what we were saying about life on the road and talk about some of the stories we have on the road. One of the things that you done with me was you give me balance in bodybuilding. You knew that I didn't miss a beat. You know that I wasn't into the nightclubs and stuff like this, but we still always had a lot of fun.
Oh, we did.
Again, we've gone to different countries, and I remember one time.
Remember India?
Oh, shit.
Tell me, we've got to talk about India, because we were there, and you remember going on the beach there?
Oh, we woke up in the morning, sunshine. I text you. I said, hey, there's a lot of people on the beach. You want to go down?
Yeah.
We went to the beach. And as we were walking into the beach, we were staying in the nice hotel, the Ritz.
Really nice
and
hotel.
And it backed up to that beach, which looked nice. And then the security guy goes, hey, flagging us down.
Don't
and
go on
and
the
we
beach.
Were like, hey, don't go on the beach. We were like, why? See them guys over there? Yeah, they're swimming. No, they're shitting
they're
in the water.
Shitting in
and
the water.
We were like, what? So we got closer to the, because you and I are like, we got to check this out.
See this.
So let's stay away from the shit. But they were all like up to their waist and they were bobbing along and there was loads of people out there and they went out there to piss and shit in the water.
Piss and shit in the water. I was so disgusted with that.
We nearly went in that bucket.
I was like, that's the Indian Ocean. I'm going to go swimming. I'm like, nah, I'm not swimming in the Indian Ocean. I'm not going in there.
We were going like, should we just put a toe in to officially say? And we're like, no, there's so much bacteria. But yeah, that's true. That trip, they'd done the World Championships there. They hosted it in a cricket ground. And there was, I just remember standing on the stage and looking back. And
remember the amount of fans?
That's what I'm saying.
And they were attacking us.
Can you remember that they give us this guideline? They were like, don't stand here, stand in the X. And for the viewers that are watching this, Rich kind of matches to his own beat of his drum sometimes. Yeah. So we go out there, we stand in the wrong position, and the pyrotechnics went off and blew your eardrum.
Yeah, my ear, I couldn't hear it.
You were fucking deaf for 2 or 3 days. And I was talking, he was like, Flex, I can't, you're nothing, you got to talk into this here. So everywhere we went, you would just have to turn your head and talk to people like this, swiveling head. But
and then the poverty, like we were there, and because I went to India years later, it's much better now. But there was just, remember we were there because we were the only like white people, and these kids were like following us, like we were like
everywhere.
Pied Piper.
Yes.
And if you gave them like a couple coins, you just have a pile of kids just following you around.
I don't know why also this sticks out to my head and why you decided to do this, but during this trip, Rich decided to have his eyes tested. He fucking felt he was going blind during this. The amount of times we've had laughs on this, so but Rich was like, Flex, my eyes are bad. I go, it's probably because we're in India, mate. And you're like, no, my eyes are... I think I might
glasses.
Have to... So we go to an optometrist. In India, first of all, we walk in there. We get dropped off. People see three white guys walking into this optician.
Yeah.
And they closed the door. Security guys came. And then a mob formed outside.
All around the window.
Banging the windows. The security guy starts freaking out. And you were like, eh, whatever. And I was like, Rich, you go in the back room. You get your eyes tested. All the standard.
Yeah, check it.
And then listen to this. After all this rigmarole, he still decides not to get a pair of glasses. So now we start walking towards the front door. And I turn to Rich. I go, Rich.
There's 300 kids, people.
They were banging the windows, and we had to get security. We had to get the police. The police were so nasty. They were the batons and stuff. And then we had no car. The car left
we
us.
We had no car.
So we're like, what the fuck do we do? So we had to go back into the opticians and wait for the
car to come.
But yeah, that was a crazy, because we went to the show. Somebody died. And they were like, show must go on.
Yeah,
somebody fell from the rafters.
And died.
And they put us in one of these driving services. And we had these kids on motorbikes. Like five on a motorbike, they were pulling up next to us, take a picture, and we were out the window. Hey, and then the same guy was there fucking five or six times. Like, how many photos do you want of me and Rich in the car waving at you? But we had a mob everywhere we went. But then Poland was another funny one. We were training and we were in Ted's gym. And just,
oh, with the animals.
And we were training along and he was like, hey, you want to see my goat? And then he opens up this door in his gym and there's a fucking goat right
there's
in his
goat
gym.
In the gym.
Like, I was like, what the hell?
Yeah, there was a goat. God. And what else was in there? There was a bunch of animals. Like,
somebody chained up. I don't know.
We're like training in the gym and there's farm animals in the gym.
Running around. But we've got some great memories. And again, I'm very, there's so many that I giggle at, from our little nightly escapades to strip clubs. Rich was like, hey, you're awake. I'm fucking jet lagged. What's open? Nothing, Rich. Oh, let's find something. So we ended up in
I'm hungry.
Let's go. Which somehow we ended up in this Polish strip club.
Yeah, I don't know.
With Mark Alvisi.
Yeah, with Mark Alvisi.
Mark Alvisi and me, and we were trying to get some food. And
so I wanted everything open was a strip club to go
that
eat.
Served food.
That served food.
That served food. And we were getting mobbed by people who couldn't speak English. And we were trying to eat. And we were just like, oh, fuck, Rich. Let's just fucking scarf this down and go. But yeah, I've had such a great look back on them times. And a true apprenticeship. And it was earned. You never made it easy for me. You made it that I had to earn my stripes.
Yeah.
And then when I earned my stripes, I was rewarded, right? But it wasn't like, hey, do this, you get this. It was all through sweat equity. And
yes.
And every year, per performance base or per what I'd done, I would get rewarded through salary, whatever it would be. And for me, it was never about the money. Because the journey of the experience I had, again, how many people, if they look back in bodybuilding and that have had crazy contracts, and they were that athlete that just had to turn up at the Olympia, and they got this, they had to go here, they had to go there, but they were an athlete.
Yeah,
I had experiences. I get to see the world, see it with you, train in different gyms, get to sightsee, then come back home, shut shop for a couple of weeks. And even then, we still would work all the way up till maybe 8 weeks out. And then I would knuckle down and not travel just to focus on that. So a lot of guys that are listening right now, oh, I don't want to travel. It's 4 weeks, 4 months until the Olympia, 3 months until the Olympia. Listen, fucker, I traveled all the way up until sometimes 6 weeks out. Yeah. And then
I try to make sure it was local, not...
Yes,
it wasn't to Europe. It was like maybe a 2-hour flight, go there and come back.
Yeah, but I worked nonetheless, and as did you. And I think that's one of the things that I learned from you was like, I can't even say yeah, but because you've done it, you already had paved the way. You had achieved what you achieved in bodybuilding through your systematic approach, and I was learning it again through the lessons straight next to you. When you worked, I worked. And when you trained, I trained. And again, when you had a business meeting, I was in the business meeting. That's an apprenticeship that no amount of money, no amount of contract could have paid me to have. I would have been, like I said, an athlete, but I had an athlete apprenticeship experience, which now has forged so many different things in my life that even lessons that I didn't even know that I was learning then, now have transitioned into the multiple things that I'm doing. So for me to you, thank you for seeing that and just giving me the opportunity.
I was the Mr. Miyagi. What am I doing this for?
Yeah.
This is the reason why.
Yeah. Rich, tell us, where we at with the podcast? I know we've hammered on for a long time here. Hour and 40 minutes. Yeah, so much for my hour podcast. But Rich, in landing this plane, you have been, I would say, an advocate for every chapter of your life you've lived, right? You've been the teenage bodybuilder, you've been the legend that you've created for yourself in bodybuilding. You've now the business elements. You truly are, in my eyes, the comeback kid. Never don't sleep on me. I'll prove to you if you don't believe in me. You've been bankrupt. You've got it all. You've driven the best of cars. You've lost it all again. The biggest of houses. You've lost it all. You've started again. And one of the things that I have the utmost respect for you on is that whatever cards you've been dealt in losing everything, you've got back on your feet and you've chased the dream again. And I know That's fucking hard to do. It's very hard to do. You have to humble yourself and again, just get back up, pull your bridges up and get back to work. It's, how have you been able to do that so many times? And now you're sitting on the throne again, having gone through so many things over the years. Where does that motivation come from?
Sometimes I don't know where it comes from. It's something within me. Maybe it's my dad, who I think about, came from a war-torn country and from Italy, came to America with $5 in his pocket, building what he was able to build in houses and rentals. And he always told me one thing. He said, I wasn't born here in this country. You were. You should take all the opportunity to make yourself. You should be way above what I could ever be, because you should be on my shoulders beyond whatever I can do. And my dad had a second grade education, was able to make millions in real estate because he worked hard. And he just said, never give up. And you're never a loser. If you never give up, you're never a loser. You're always a winner. And it may not, what happens is, as long as you don't give up, you're going to be able to carve a path. Maybe it's not the exact path that you're thinking, but you're going to carve a path to be successful. And age is just a number. I believe truly that if you judge yourself by saying, I need to be at this position at this age, it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes things fall. And like you said, I've had millions of dollars. I've lost millions of dollars. I've gained back millions of dollars. And I'm a little more careful now, by the way, because I want to keep, you know, what I have. But like I said, I just never give up and never. And that's what I feel for anyone out there that wants to be successful. You are always a winner as long as you don't give up. Mm-hmm. Be realistic in what your goals are. From all my experiences, I have a lot of connections with that's helped me move forward to be able to carve different paths in my life because of the customer base I have or the connections I have. All those things are, like you said, you've had learning lessons. I have a lot of learning lessons that I look at something and say, okay, what do I do now? And the other thing that I told you is like waking up every day and being humble and having gratitude. If you can have gratitude, and you're not going to say to yourself, why did this happen to me? You got to just say, you know what? There's other people worse off. There's people that are sick in the hospital, or they're dead broke living in a country that they can never make it. But you have to admit, you're here in this country. This country is a land of opportunity, I believe, still. I hope it stays that way. But when my dad told me, coming from an immigrant family, that this is the land of opportunity, I came here to give you a better life. So take advantage of it. And that's something that I've always thought to myself. That was something that my dad taught me to do. And that's to this day, I'll never give up. And now I have children and I want to show them the same thing, that you got to just keep trying. I have a 4-year-old son. And for me, I want to be around. Remember, he talked about my health issues. I want to make sure I'm alive to be in his life, so that I can teach him the way I've been able to teach you the same thing. Because now I have kids. I have a 16-year-old daughter that's getting ready, that you saw, used to hold. Sophia. And she's getting ready to look for colleges and stuff. So it's just an amazing thing.
Yeah, full transition. And at 60 years old, to have a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
That definitely keeps you on your feet, I'm sure.
Very much. He keeps me very young. Yeah. And this kid is Rich Gasparri, my clone. Tons of energy.
Yeah.
He looks like me, by the way. And he's just this kid that I look at him, I said, man, this kid's me. And I want this kid to be the best ever. You know that you have kids now, and you want your kids to be better than you and have a better life than you. Because, listen, you lived a life in the UK, a Welsh guy with not a lot of money, coming here, now successful, doing great. And you want your kids to do even better than you.
It's the immigrant mentality, I think, that your dad had and that installed into you. And that work ethic of seeing your dad working them long hours and then you being able to be like, I don't want to do that.
No, he didn't want to be a mason.
I don't want to be grinding and not getting paid what I feel I should be paid. You carved your own life. You created your own opportunities. There wasn't.
Know your worth also.
Yeah, know your worth.
Know your worth. Yeah. That's very important. I've been around a long time, and I don't accept less than I know what I'm worth.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps me, you know, up there.
Yeah. And Yeah, and obviously you got to, not to prolong the podcast any longer, but you got to see the infancy stage of my relationship with my wife and what has been created through that. You were at the wedding.
Yes.
You got to reconnect with a couple of people, Ed Corners. I think we put you on the same table as Ed Corners.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Listen, I think Ali was one of the best things in your life. I can see that both of you are a team together.
Yeah.
That both of you grow together. She's able to help your weaknesses Absolutely. And her weaknesses. And I can see that I'm very happy that you were able to find that and have this great relationship that continues on. And this is, for every great man, there's a great woman. And she's there, right there with you.
I couldn't agree more, mate. And you were there. You seen it happen. You were at the expo.
Yes.
You were at the wedding.
Yeah.
You may have eaten a couple of things that you shouldn't have eaten.
Oh, shit. We'll talk about that. Yeah.
But don't say what you want to talk about us? Fuck it. Pop the cherry.
Yeah,
well, the wedding was great, first of all.
You had a great wedding. Beautiful wedding.
Yeah.
You know, huge place. So afterward, he had this after party.
He wasn't invited for every.
So we go there. And, you know, I'm here having a good time, drinking a little bit. And then this girl comes up with this tray. She goes, oh, would you like one? Oh, brownies. And I was hungry. I took three of them. I ate them all. So then she goes, why'd you do that? I'm like, what do you mean? Oh, they were laced with THC. You're going to be fucked up. Within an hour later, I was so messed up. To this day, I'm afraid to take any. Now that it's legal and everything, I'm like, no, I'm not taking that.
First of all, my wedding wasn't like some big drug party.
No.
But for the viewers watching at home, we myself and my wife got married at the Boca Resort for everyone
beautiful
who doesn't
place.
Know. It's a beautiful place. And we ended up having, the room that I had was the suite, the biggest suite, and it wraps the whole top floor. So I didn't even know who the hell was in, because I was on the one side of the suite, and then as it wrapped right around the
you
building.
You didn't know they were bringing drugs into your room.
I didn't even know what was here. All I know is my mother was on that side. I went to find her, and my mother's up and dancing. I was like, what the fuck? She's, oh, I just had a brownie from so-and-so. No names mentioned. I was like, what? And then as the night went on, I progressively seen people who knew that they were eating brownies and what was in them. They knew. One of my friends was trying to get the elevator, and it was fucking hilarious. I wish I filmed it. He was trying to push the button and to get the elevator down to his room, and he kept on missing the button. This guy was there for about 2 or 3 minutes, which is a lifetime when in his eyes. He was like, he kept the button, kept on moving. But you were one of the victims walking around. And then I had all my Welsh friends that were there that were drinking, and, you know, they continued the party onto the Boca Resort Hotel grounds where I think they went right through. I've seen them in the morning. But yeah,
memorable wedding
that I had a lot of fun in. And obviously you got to see then that full circle of meeting Ali and then to getting married. And now my kids, and to your point, the motivation I have right now, I was a highly motivated young kid, and you knew that, obviously you assigned me. But now the motivation I have for other things now is the transitional period. And I know that you've lived this chapter. I'm obviously now moving into other elements, the businesses and speaking and doing more things than I never thought at the time I would do. In fact, actually, you helped me start my first business, if you can remember. It was my smoothie bar in Tennessee.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, you came in, and I want to say thank you for that, too, because I started my first official tax-paying business outside of being a professional athlete in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, which is now the Carbon Culture Gym. It used to be Franklin Athletic Club, Franklin, Tennessee. And I had the smoothie bar in there, and I killed it.
That's why? Right, I remember.
Because Rich used to give me so much sample packs that I would open up the sample packs, and it was like free fucking money. But no, these guys, I got everybody on all the products. Super Pump 250 was the big Mac Daddy at the time.
Yeah.
And I just seeing just how the brand, not only from the athlete standpoint, but also then as the business owner, how big the brand got. Because when you have consumers and gym goers that don't look like bodybuilders rocking Gaspire Nutrition shirts that they got given and in promos and then the expos and stuff like that, it was incredible. Again, these people weren't bodybuilders. They weren't like you and I. They were the general gym goer.
Yeah.
And then for me to see that, again, as I felt that it was a big part of the brand, it was amazing. And we truly, in many expos, when it was blue versus red, the BSN rivalry days,
We've done some crazy things.
We've done some crazy activations, and it was fun times. And I've said this, it was probably the funnest times I've ever had, because after that point, it became, I was the racehorse. and I got signed as the racehorse. And as obviously the years have gone on and I've done other things with other brands, it never was the same. It was the get paid to jump in a plane, land somewhere, jump in a limo or a town car or whatever else and go to an appearance, go to my hotel, and that's it. So the brotherhood that I had, that I understood much more when I became the athlete like these other guys started off. Again, not to rehash everything, man, it was an experience that, unfortunately, a lot of athletes will never have. There's nobody that will ever do what you've done for me. And now with social media, that element of having to go places really isn't there anymore.
Much, yeah.
So we lived the life. I wore the T-shirt. And one thing I'll say is what you asked of me, you would do yourself.
Exactly.
And that is one of the reasons why, you know, the success of Rich Gaspari will continue to do whatever you do. And now you're moving into, you got the documentary as you opened the show with that's coming in November. You've got a book out. Obviously, being 60 years old now and looking in the shape you're looking in, you've been preaching about taking care of your body after 50 now for a decade. And you've done so many different things. You've achieved so many incredible accolades, feathers to the hat. And I'm excited for what's next to come for Rich Gaspari.
There's more chapters to come.
A lot more chapters to come. I think, again, with that being said, with more chapters to come, I'm excited to bring you on a future episode and
definitely
and talk about much more, including the documentary. So
beautiful.
Congratulations, Rich. You said that documentary is
November, the weekend of the Olympia. They're going to be releasing it. It's going to be on Amazon Prime, Hulu. A lot of the streaming videos are going to have it. Not on Netflix, but it's going to be on all the other ones.
Cool.
You'll see it. I'm going to be putting it out there on social media. They're going to have me on talk shows. I'm going to get interviewed. So it will be out there, and so people will see it.
Get behind Rich, guys. And this story is one that not only will motivate you, but you'll get a year of things that obviously we haven't spoken about here on the podcast and actually see real-time footage that has been shot over, my goodness, five decades.
Yes. They got
6 decades.
Not that long.
You're 60.
Yeah, but I don't have it when I was an infant.
I don't know. Yeah, try. Big huge camcorder. But yeah, Rich, thank you for your time. Obviously, you've truly come in just to do this podcast all the way from New Jersey, which is a fun.
When you asked me and I said, I'm very proud of you, like seeing what you've been able to do, the Dragon's Lair and all the other things you've done and the endorsements. I'm really proud of you. I said, man, I saw this in this 22-year-old kid that was basically come from Wales and saw this potential, and it's really cool to see.
Oh, thank you.
And for me, I'm always there as your cheerleader to see the success.
As I am of yours.
Thank you.
As I am of yours, mate. And thank you again. And yeah, the Dragon Slayer and the Welsh Dragon was a combination that I think everybody loved to play on. You'd sign me unknowing that I was the Welsh Dragon and you were the Dragon Slayer. But thankfully, Rich Gaspari never slayed Flex.
No, he didn't slay you.
We tried in the gym many times.
I ended up having you as my pet. You
know, like, my pet!
And I had the Asian dragon, too.
Asian dragon, with Hide. Yeah, you're just looking for dragons.
You just love dragons.
Yeah, you just love them. Fucking slaying them all over the place. But, man, that's it for the podcast. If there's anything else you want to plug and push, I think you've already talked about it, right?
Talked about it. Gaspari Nutrition lives on. We're still promoting a brand, coming up with new products constantly. There's going to be some big changes in the brand as well. We got Gaspari Ageless. I'm coming up with, I don't want to really talk about it yet, but we're coming up with a product that's going to launch in Europe. It's going to be a drink. It's going to be under Rich Gaspari, but it's a new brand that's going to be coming out as well.
Who's on exclusive?
It's going to be, what do you mean by
exclusive for the podcast? You haven't talked about it.
Oh, we could talk about that. Yeah,
So, no, I'm saying this is the first time you're talking about it?
I'm talking about it, yes.
Fantastic. Thanks for that, man. So again, you've got everything going on with Gaspari. We're growing all over the world. You've obviously got a massive fan base in, we spoke about Japan, there's killing in Japan, Korea, and all over the world.
The Asian world is really growing.
And I'm excited for the future of Rich Gaspari, and we'll get you back on in the future to talk about all the things that we didn't talk about, maybe some other stories that we should have talked about but didn't. But anyways, this is Straight Out the Lair. Rich Gaspari, the legend himself, has finally happened. You guys asked for it. Flex Lewis, Straight Out the Lair. We are out.